This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A lot in today's show you're going to want to listen for. A day after that shooting in the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard, details about the crime and the lone shooter. We'll talk to our own Todd Zwillick about how the Capitol is dealing with the aftermath. We'll end this hour with part two of my conversation with Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who in the midst of my interview, it turned out, was quite happy to answer my 15-year-old daughter's question about the Second Amendment. It was an amazing answer. Along the way, we'll continue our bike tour of changing American transportation culture, one haiku at a time. But first, to Syria. A long-awaited United Nations report delivers no surprises about chemical weapons.
This is a war crime and grave violation of the 1925 Protocol and other rules of international law.
The voice of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking about the attack last month that began the latest international crisis. It's the first official confirmation by scientific experts that chemical weapons have been used in Syria. In the meantime, negotiations over international action have drawn in an unlikely group of international players: the U.S., France, Britain, Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, all at the table with others weighing in as well. Can these players actually agree on a coherent course of action? We're joined by Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Welcome back, Robin.
Hi, John. Always great to be with you.
You know, let's explore the different interests between, say, the United States and Britain and a Turkey and a Saudi Arabia. Could we begin with Turkey?
Well, Turkey faces a real challenge on a number of layers. First of all, it's taken in almost 500,000 refugees from Syria already. And so this is a physical, logistical burden, financial burden on Turkey. But it also reflects a real change in the attitude of the whole region about President Assad. Prime Minister Erdogan and President Assad once went on vacation with their families together. Mm. They were actually very close. Turkey had significant commercial interests. But after the uprising began, Turkey really distanced itself quickly and was one of the leading voices saying Assad no longer had legitimacy. And so politically, this was a critical turning point that also, I think, gave heft to the international community, gave them a sense that this was a moment that the world needed to take a common stand. And Prime Minister Erdogan's been arguably the most important regional player so far.
Although because of that refugee problem that is a physical, tangible crisis in Turkey, a simple sort of punishment of Assad and dealing only with the chemical weapons changes nothing on the ground if the civil war continues, right?
Exactly. And I think the outside world is sighing with relief that there's no military strike, but losing sight of the longer term gain and the fact that nothing really changes on the ground. And in fact, even while we're all focusing on the chemical weapons report, the fact is something like 1,000 people have died in the past 2 weeks in Syria as a result, as the war has actually escalated. And the process that's been outlined does nothing so far to deal with this very tough reality.
Does it make sense that the Saudi Arabians seem to be supporting the generals in Egypt and the opposition in Syria?
Isn't it wild? There's a real realignment of forces in the region. Look, the Gulf countries are not very happy with Assad. They really feel that he has betrayed his people, ironically. But the issue is less democracy. The Gulf countries have been supporting some of the rebel fighters, reportedly providing both financial support and paying for weaponry. And Saudi Arabia, Qatar, although they're supporting different wings of the opposition, have been instrumental in ways that the United States and its European allies have not wanted to play.
And again, the Saudis are in it for the long haul. They're not necessarily just involved in some sort of punishment for Assad. Let's move to the Russians now. Of course, there's a division between Russia and the United States on the wording of any sort of Security Council resolution regarding actual military action. But what's the long-term Russian play here? I've heard reports from Moscow that Syria has an emotional attachment to Russia, not unlike what Cuba once had during the Cold War, and that that Russia will not sell out Assad.
Yes, I think that's part of it. Look, they have quite tangible connections, whether it's the Russians selling them arms. Syria has been Russia's most important ally dating back to the days of the Soviet Union in the Arab world. Russia uses a Syrian port, its only access to the Mediterranean. But there are more political issues that are also at stake in Syria. A senior Russian official once told me that the outside world didn't understand that it was not just about money and arms and diplomatic ties. It was really a political domestic issue for the Russians. They have a restive Muslim population. The Soviet Union had been one of the five largest Muslim countries. It shed its largest Muslim areas, but it still has a significant population. But Russia, more importantly, doesn't like the precedent that was established in Libya that allows the outside world to decide when they use force in support of an opposition, which plays out not only for some of its allies, but also might set a precedent that could apply because of the demonstrations that have gone on against Putin in Russia.
And raise the profile of Putin in the region, to be sure. Robin Wright, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Robin Wright is distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace, author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. The instability in Syria is mirrored by the continuing unpredictability in Egypt, where once promise of democracy...
It felt incredible. Here we are, the first democratically elected president in the entire history of Egypt, the first civilian to ever head Egypt in the modern era. And it was like stepping into the warm sunshine after a long, long cold winter.
That promise has become a commitment on both sides in Egypt to maintain divisions, inflame religious rivalries, and postpone constitutional democracy indefinitely.
The fatal mistake is that the Muslim Brotherhood could have turned to us, the revolutionary, and could have turned to Tahrir and to tell them, we need you to write a constitution that would limit the power of the military. We need you to curb and cleanse the very corrupt judiciary. We would have come to his rescue. And instead, he tried to flirt with the police and the military against us.
These are two voices from tonight's Frontline Egypt in Crisis, a film by Charles Sennett, co-founder and editor-at-large of Global Post. The film is produced by our partner WGBH in Boston. Charles Sennett is here in the studio. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks, John.
So much there. Really, the promise of democracy become a kind of stalemate of ideas as well as politics, and you've witnessed it firsthand.
Yeah, we've been covering this Frontline and Global Post together since the very first days of Tahrir Square, when you had that amazing moment of hope, a sense that for all of us who've covered the region for a long time, that the people had actually risen up and overthrown a dictatorship. This would be Mubarak after 30 years of police state. And to think where we've gone to now, 2.5 years later, where that hope has dissipated, violence really rules, the street rules, tremendously lost opportunity here, I think, for American foreign policy. I think we did not hear the voices of the Arab street. I think the White House has been tone deaf on the Arab Spring. And I don't think anything drives that home as much as Egypt does.
Is that an easy accusation to make in the sense that, I mean, so many of us thought this hope and this kind of Jeffersonian democracy was going to sweep across the region. And what we've seen is that, in fact, the end of these dictatorships opens a huge Pandora's box of issues, some of which are thousands of years old, some of which are right on the surface. And it's almost naive to think that this was going to take anything short of decades.
It's idealistic, certainly. I think it's not an unfair expectation. I think the Egyptian people have a wonderful culture, a rich culture. They're well educated. They want a better country. You know, when you go back 30 years when Mubarak first took power, Egypt was on par with South Korea economically. Now look where those two countries are now. South Korea is an economic powerhouse. Egypt is a basket case these days. The dictatorships like Mubarak that the United States propped up and supported gave us what we thought was stability over democracy. Then President Obama gave a stunning and stirring speech in June of 2009 where he went to Cairo University, and said, democracy is a universal right. You know, the people on the street heard that. They believed it. And I think it had a lot to do as a triggering mechanism for the Arab Spring. But I do think the White House, I think President Obama, was slow to recognize what was happening in Egypt, what was happening in the Arab Spring. And I think in that time, we lost an opportunity to find a way to engage with Islamists who are democratic, who believe in democracy. The biggest dividing line between the Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda is that Muslim Brotherhood has always, for decades, believed in the democratic system, and they fought to be part of it. Then they win the election, and we don't really support it when a coup starts to happen. Now, al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is Egyptian, who comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood, who rejects democracy, who embraces violence, he now looks to the Muslim Brotherhood and says, you know, we told you that democracy was a Western plant and that it would mean nothing if you actually got elected.
Suddenly that's persuasive.
And there's an argument there on the street that the people here in al-Qaeda seems to be winning in that argument, or at least rubbing it in the faces of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Let me ask you, if you think that the White House was slow on Egypt, what do you think of the schedule on Syria then?
Well, I think Syria is just a tragedy of a completely different proportion. I think one of the most interesting things about the Arab Spring is that every country has its own reality, and there is no reality more dark than Syria. You know, when we all met Bashar al-Assad after his father's funeral, there was like this moment where we could meet him. We went, and he was this young leader who understood the internet. And you know something he does? He's effectively controlled the internet in a way that the Mubarak regime never even understood it. Remember, we used to call Tahrir Square the Facebook revolution. In Syria, there's been a very interesting dynamic in which I think he does understand the digital age. I think he also understands that as an Alawite minority, he's going to do whatever it takes to hold on to power. And we've seen the darkest sides of that dictatorship come out. I think that the Obama administration, you know, has been halting and not paying attention, and I think it's all caught up now, and I think we're really in a tough bind. I'm thrilled that diplomacy won the day with some hard work by diplomats and peacemakers, if you want to call them that, over the last week. But during that week, 1,000 more people were killed in the war in Syria.
Charles Sennett is co-founder and editor-at-large of Global Post. His forthcoming Frontline film, produced by our partner WGBH, is called Egypt in Crisis. Be sure to catch it. It airs on PBS tonight. Charles, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, we're going to talk to Chicago Transportation Commissioner Gabe Klein, credited for creating the first successful bike share model in the United States. We'll talk about how bike culture is sweeping the country. And our takeaway bike challenge continues. Give us your bike-oo.
On bike, grinding uphill, I loathe you, gravity. Oh, but downhill, love.
WNYC's own Jim O'Grady giving us a haiku at thetakeaway.org. Submit your haiku about your bike and enter our Takeaway Bike Challenge. Bike riders of Takeaway Nation, unite.
The world spins around.
Nearing bridge crest by bike.
Bike wheels spin around the world.
Sometimes you brake.
Climbing up higher, strenuously pedaling.
Wind is in my face.
My bike does me right.
Blue bike is my takeaway.
Bike Nation, we live in it, and this week we've been exploring a cultural revolution around bikes that is changing cities, lifestyles, and energy consumption across the nation. In August 2008, in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital became the model for the first successful bicycle sharing system in the country. From modest beginnings, Capital Bike Share now boasts nearly 200,000 riders and 2.3 million trips per year. Until New York launched its bike share program, it was the largest in North America. And today there are bike shares in cities across the country, Denver and San Francisco, Chicago and Boston. We would love to see these cities compete to see which is the bike sharingest community in America. But, you know, we wanted to do something that would involve all of you, from Car Culture Orlando to freeway jammed Los Angeles. Are you riding a bicycle, considering it? Here's the challenge. Submit a haiku about your bike riding experience. It can be about your bike, about your journey, maybe even about that dusty bike sitting in the garage, unused. Instructions at thetakeaway.org. Three judges will vote and select their top 10 picks, and winners will get takeaway bike helmets. Hey, I don't even have one of those. Can you do better than these entries?
80-mile bike ride. Wow, I am a superstar. Can't feel my butt, though.
Greening of Detroit starts with less exhaust pipe fumes and more pedaling.
Wheels and muscles move, jockeying for position, breathing hard, alive.
In order to submit your haiku, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Submissions are being accepted for 6 more days. You have from now until 11:59 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, September 22nd, to take part. We think haikus are infectious, kind of like bike riding. And the man who launched the bike share craze, Washington, D.C.'s bike share program, Gabe Klein, is now spreading the bike message as transportation commissioner for Chicago, where he oversees trains, roads, bridges, buses, and bikes.
The economy's changing. Cities are changing. We are re-urbanizing in America's cities. And you have a whole new generation of people and new technologies that are basically changing the way we live, work, and play in cities.
And the ownership piece of transportation becomes more discretionary, maybe a leisure thing. And the public transportation piece regarding bicycles and even cars, if you include like zip cars and some other sort of public car options, that becomes all about this real challenge in urbanization, getting that last mile to work between the bus system, the subway system, the light rail, whatever public transit system, and the actual front door of the house. It's the last mile that's the real challenge. How does bike share help that?
You're absolutely right. People need different modes of transport for different times of the day, for different uses, depending on the size of their family. And it is often that last mile that's challenging for people. You can go out and get to the L station or the MTA subway station, but it may be 6 or 8 blocks away. And the bus may only run every 20 minutes. So instant access, point-to-point transportation is extremely important, whether it be with a car, a bike, or some other mode. And bike share, what's so great about it is that it's something that you can implement relatively quickly and is an absolute game changer in a city, particularly for that last mile and, to be honest, for recreational use as well.
Why did you know it would work in D.C. and why did you know it could be replicated around the country?
Well, you know, I had studied a bit about, you know, Paris and how this had worked in other countries. One of my predecessors had done a small pilot in Washington, D.C. with a program called Smart Bike. And then I'd been to Montreal and seen the Bixi bike share system firsthand. And what so impressed me by that system versus the previous iterations was the fact that, yes, it had this cool, you know, software and technology that allowed you to know where the bikes were all the time and made it very easy for the consumer. But from a business standpoint, from the government standpoint, having the ability to literally drop a station in 20 to 30 minutes, no construction, no wiring it to the power grid, and then to be able to expand it on the fly was like nothing else out there in transportation. And so I knew that it could be hugely successful in Washington, D.C.
Well, you know, we have a bike contest going here. We've actually encouraged our takeaway folks who love the show, who love to think about these ideas, who also love their bikes, to submit haikus describing their bike experience. How successful do you think that would be? I mean, a haiku is kind of like a bicycle of poetry. You know, you can take it wherever you go.
Oh, I think it'll be great. You know, I had the opportunity to meet David Byrne, who wrote a book about biking all over the world as he tours and does his concerts. And one of the things you realize when you're reading that book is riding a bike through a city is like poetry. It's like poetry in motion. And you have the ability to, as Jan Gehl, a famous architect from Copenhagen, says, to really see a city at human scale. And for me personally, I get a lot of my thinking done, even, you know, things that I need to do at work. It's like a bit of meditation on your bike. And so I think that seems very appropriate, although personally, I'm not a poet, but I will wish you the best of luck on that.
When it's pouring rain and you're on a bike share bike, how do you get yourself to your destination? What is the sort of Zen kind of mantra that works for you, Gabe Klein?
For me, you know, personally, I need to have the right gear. So I keep my suits at work often, and I have nice rain gear so I can ride in the rain. And I love riding in the rain, as long as I'm not going to be soaked to the core when I get to work. And so I think preparation is key. And, you know, realizing that you're not going to melt.
Keep a towel in your desk.
Oh, absolutely. I actually do that.
I knew you were going to say that. Commissioner Gabe Klein of the Chicago Department of Transportation, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, John.
We want your bikus.
I ride silently. Filthy noisemakers pass me, one person in each.
Modern metal steed, sturdy and ready to ride. Your power is mine.
Rolling resistance, heart beating, wind in my face. Pedal on, live long.
Bikus. You know, I think I'm going to call the Oxford English Dictionary on that one. I think we're nailing it. To participate in our bike challenge, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find the rules there. Winners get takeaway bike helmets. And you can find a photo of me on my bike, who maybe should be riding it a little bit more. You can see that as well.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
The Navy family suffered a horrific attack.
Defense contractor went on a shooting rampage.
We don't have any known motive.
34-year-old Aaron Alexis, the suspect.
Witnesses report a hail of bullets in hallways and from a balcony.
We're doing all the coordination with the FBI and our security forces, D.C.
As we try to piece together the recent movements and contacts of the subject.
The president's been getting regular updates on the investigation from Homeland Security.
We send our thoughts and prayers to all at the Navy Yard who've been touched by this tragedy.
We know a lot more about what happened at the Washington Navy Yard when a single shooter started shooting yesterday morning. He's been identified, as you heard, as 34-year-old Aaron Alexis, discharged by the Navy in 2011 for what an official described as a pattern of misconduct. Alexis was armed with an AR-15 assault rifle, a shotgun, and a handgun. The mass shooting is marked as the worst loss of life in a single incident in the D.C. area since the September 11th, 2001 attack on the Pentagon that killed 184 people. Joining us now, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So is it back to business as usual in the Capitol today or what?
It mostly is back to business. A lot of the neighborhood around the Washington Navy Yard in Southeast D.C. near Capitol Hill has been reopened. People are returning to work. In fact, some people returned to work yesterday evening at the Navy Yard despite the investigation. And as you alluded to, John, Washington this morning as it wakes up is, to the extent that these things are ranked in our minds, is clearly referring to this as the worst day since 9/11.
The issue that he was able to get into this compound because he used an ID of someone who had been dismissed, this certainly seems like a premeditated act of disgruntled employee, which almost is sad in the sense that this has become such a banal ritual in the United States in our time.
Well, what we know about Aaron Alexis so far, John, there is quite a lot of history that's being reported out, some of it violent, couple of gun incidents, disorderly contact, but none of it goes to motive in this case. His motive is still a mystery. We know that he was discharged as a full-time Navy reservist. Three incidents on his record, as reported by the Washington Post, including one in 2004 where he apparently shot through the tires of a car in his neighborhood after a confrontation with some construction workers. Friends describing, again in the Washington Post, John, a friendly, warm person who hung out at a Buddhist temple, who was religious, who worked with friends at a Thai restaurant, but who also had an anger streak. All of these things, of course, go to painting a portrait of a person, but again, none of it to motive about why Aaron Alexis used a valid government contractor ID. He was back in Washington working for a computer contractor called The Experts, a subcontractor of the HP Corporation as a computer expert. Why he used a valid ID to gain access to that building at the Washington Navy Yard installation and start shooting with it, we just don't know.
Yeah, the why is still a mystery, but clearly this was a planned incident. It's my understanding that he was a part of the upgrade of the computer system at the Navy Yard.
The Experts, which is the name of this company, is a subcontractor that was helping to participate in computer upgrades at Navy and Marine installations worldwide. And he was apparently hired on to help with that upgrade.
You know, when there was a shooting at City Hall here in New York, from that moment on, the security arrangements completely changed at City Hall, and metal detectors, the whole works. Any talk of changing security at the Navy Yard?
Absolutely, and that's all in the early stages of assessment. Anytime there's an incident here as well, John, there are security changes, recriminations, and the rest. So in the after-action time, both among military commanders and planners and in the media, frankly, there are already a great deal of questions. He had a valid pass, so of course he could enter a building, but he did it with three weapons. Nobody knows how that could have happened. That is certainly going to be part of an assessment that goes on here as life kind of starts to get back to normal in that neighborhood of Capitol Hill and Southeast Washington, John.
Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Reports emerging today that Mr. Alexis, the deceased shooter in D.C., had been suffering a host of mental issues, including paranoia and a sleep disorder. This, according to law enforcement officials quoted by the Associated Press, he'd been treated since August by the Veterans Administration for mental problems, but again, no clear motive in any of these reports. Iran is a nation with more than 2,000 years of recorded history. Yet for most Americans, year zero is 1979.
It was the most incredible scene. Nobody could possibly know how many millions lined the route of his 20-mile drive through Tehran. But it could not have been less than three.
The Iranian Revolution, led by Ayatollah Khomeini, the overthrow of the Shah and the attack on the U.S. Embassy, and the taking of hostages.
We continue to face a grave situation in Iran, where our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
From that moment, the only history of Iran and the United States was a vengeful accounting of the truth by Iran that the U.S. CIA was responsible for regime change back in 1953. It was.
Further pictures from Tehran show rioters in action as anti-royalist partisans, supporters of the aged Dr. Mossadegh, set about their work of destruction. Target on which much bitter feeling was focused was the statue of the Shah's father.
From the American side, it was always the good guys in the CIA fighting the terrorist monsters in Tehran.
You need a script?
Argo. Science, fantasy, adventure.
Moonscape, Mars, desert.
You need an exotic location to shoot.
You need a producer.
If I'm doing a fake movie, it's going to be a fake hit.
The based on a true story Academy Award movie Argo last year, another sign that the mythology and mutual suspicion between the U.S. and Iran is alive and well.
There are various art journals.
But on Manhattan's east side at the Asia Society Museum, there's another chapter of U.S.-Iranian history on display.
Iran during this time was very open, cosmopolitan. There were many Jews practicing in Iran, many other religions. One of the defining features, if you had to define modernism in Iran, is actually pluralism. And that's what we see here. We see works on paper, paintings, sculptures, photographs. And it was a real kind of, if anything, a blossoming of the art scene.
That's Melissa Chu, director of the Asia Society Museum, describing the exhibit Iran Modern. It's the story of Iran in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, told through art and revealing a thriving golden age of pluralism, pride, and openness, the artifacts of which still exist in canvases, sculpture, and memories that left Iran in the 1970s.
The first challenge was actually in terms of finding the material, because the curators Fereh Daftari and Leila Diba traveled the world. I mean, there are loans here from Dubai, London, Amiens, Paris, Los Angeles, New York, I mean, all over the world. And most of the works were from private collections, so they were in people's homes. There are 4 to 5 million Iranians in diaspora living outside of Iran. So there was an idea that there are substantial holdings already outside of Iran that we could do the show.
It's a history of Iran pieced together in a kind of archaeology of the diaspora. A glittery piece acquired in Pittsburgh from the Andy Warhol Museum tells the story of a collaboration barely imaginable today.
Monir Farman Farmian traveled to Shiraz in the 60s and saw one of the shrines, which is which has an extraordinary ceiling covered with shards of mirrors. She really was a part of the New York art scene, especially in the 50s. She collaborated with Andy Warhol on some designs, and they, in fact, exchanged artworks. This was the work that she gave to Andy Warhol, and it's now in the Andy Warhol Museum. It looks like a ball covered in various different finely cut pieces of mirror. And we might think of it as a disco ball, but she assures us she was thinking of a soccer ball. She wasn't at all interested in disco at that time.
This art and openness happened at the same time that Iran was sowing the seeds of its own political demise. The Shah, both dictator and art patron. The artists, both socially aware and detached from Iranian society. It was a moment free of the religious tensions we associate with Iran today.
I kind of think of it as being one eye on the international art scene because they were very connected, and then another eye on the local visual tradition, sometimes even popular or vernacular. And so that's the kind of tension that they walked. And I actually think that they were, in that sense, dealing with the kinds of issues that we all have to deal with today, this kind of tension between the local and the global.
You're not seeing the anxiety in Iran between the Islamic culture and the pre-Islamic culture in a work like this. You're seeing a much more interesting continuity.
Yeah, you see, I don't see so much of the tension, but rather an incorporation. These artists were actually looking to those forms, you know, that in fact it wasn't seen as a break, and it was seen as a kind of continuous culture. And, you know, they would hearken back to this idea, but modernized it.
How did these artists interact with the era of the Shah? Were they patrons of the regime? Were they in opposition to the regime? Was it just a fundamentally different kind of period?
It is hard today, I think, for a lot of people to imagine what Iran was like during this time. And that's part of the purpose of this exhibition. But it would be true to say that during the 60s and 70s, there was an unprecedented amount of state patronage of the arts.
And here there are a few examples of the kind of printed matter.
Last week, a crowd of visitors was touring the galleries, staring at paintings and collages, installations and sculptures that all seemed both completely fresh and like they were dusted off from storage in a closet, which in many cases they were. One startling piece is actually from Tehran, a large photo of the face of a man with his mouth covered by a metal stovepipe.
This is an artist called Ahmad Ali. It is the only work that we've included from Tehran. We think of it as a statement of silencing in some way, right? That it's actually this pipe directly into the artist's mouth, and there's no kind of outlet, is there?
The silence may be ending. That's the emotional hope of visitors to this gallery and diplomats who have seized on this exhibit as an opportunity to possibly change the myth of America and Iran as mortal enemies. Later this month, when the new Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, visits the U.S. to attend the United Nations General Assembly, he's made plans to pay Iran Modern a visit as well. There are reports of resumed nuclear talks in New York, an exchange of letters between Presidents Obama and Rouhani, and there's talk, so far just talk, of a possible historic meeting.
This exhibition, Iran Modern, is really about allowing people to see a period in Iran's history, the 50s, 60s, 70s, that has been forgotten somewhat. There's never been a show of this of these artists before in this way.
Melissa Chu, director of the Asia Society Museum. It's not such an outlandish idea that an art exhibit might lead to a diplomatic opening between the U.S. and Iran. It was a ping pong game that changed the history of the U.S. and China back in the 70s. Just at the moment these artists imagined their golden age would never end. Iran Modern is on display at the Asia Society Museum in New York until January 5th. We're going to end this hour with the conclusion of our interview with Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who spent the better part of an hour with us last week in the Lawyer's Lounge just down the hall from court chambers, talking about her love of the law and the court she served for more than 20 years. As a litigator, a judge, and a student of history, Ginsburg has always been sharp in her criticism of landmark decisions, a sharpness that belies her soft, whispery voice. For instance, she's a critic of the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in the U.S. It would have been far better, she says, if a woman had been on the court back then, a perspective, she says, notably absent in 1973.
There was a later case called Casey, in which Justice O'Connor did participate, and it's got a very different tone. It is centered on the woman, not on the doctor-patient relationship, and it isn't divided into trimesters. So I think looking back from that decision, we can say, yes, Justice O'Connor had been on that court, maybe she would have influenced the way the decision was explained.
You have contributed to a completely different understanding of the 14th Amendment in your time on the court, and thinking of the Ledbetter decision and the problems that we're having in America today with income disparities and outsourcing and all kinds of issues in the workplace. Does the logic of the Ledbetter decision in any sense apply to, say, undocumented workers who seem to be willing to work for lower pay, but there is a clear distinction between the wages of one class versus another class? Or is it just how the chips fall in the marketplace of America?
Undocumented aliens, unfortunately, are not protected by the law. And they are tremendously subject to exploitation. The result is that they will be willing to work for a wage that no person who is welcome in our shores would take. I think the answer to that problem is in Congress's lap. People who have been hardworking, taxpaying, those people ought to be given an opportunity to be on a track that leads toward citizenship. And if that happened, then they wouldn't be prey to the employers who say, we want you because we know that you work for a salary we could not lawfully pay anyone else. So I think it's different than Lily Ledbetter case. Lily wasn't willing to work for less than her male peers. She just didn't know she was being paid less.
Your dissent in Ledbetter led to the Congress acting to modify the law in a way that, in part, you suggested in your dissent. Some have described that your opinions are often an invitation for Congress to modify the law. Would you say that Justice Roberts' decision in the voting rights case is also an invitation to Congress to rethink preclearance, and that despite your disagreement with that decision, he's doing something similar?
He did it in Northwest Austin, a decision he cites often in the Shelby County voting rights. It was very easy to fix the law, to make clear that Title VII meant what Lily Ledbetter said it meant all along. That change, legislative change, was just informing the court, you got it wrong. This is what we meant originally, and it's what we mean today. It's quite different from the Voting Rights Act. The chief's opinion for the majority was that Congress got it wrong when it renewed the act and thinking that it could renew it without changing the coverage formula. Unlike the appeal in Ledbetter, it wasn't Congress that got it wrong, it was the court that got it wrong. And so Congress, please tell the court what you meant all along. They were different situations.
I have a 15-year-old daughter who works as a prosecutor and a judge at a youth court. And I asked her what question she would want me to ask you. And so, knowing that you might not be able to fully answer this question, I'm sure you'll find the issue to be interesting. Here's her question.
Does she believe that the Second Amendment is extremely outdated due to advances in weaponry and increased accessibility of weapons? And to what extent does the right to bear arms protect anything at this point in time?
If your daughter would read the dissenting opinion in the Heller case, she would see that my view of the Second Amendment is one based on history. The Second Amendment has a preamble about the need for a militia. Because there is a need for a militia to be at the ready, therefore, the right to keep and bear arms must be secured. Historically, the new government had no money to pay for an army, so they relied on the state militias, and the states required men to have certain weapons, and they specified in the law what weapons these people had to keep in their home so that when they were called to do service as militiamen, they would have them. That was the entire purpose of the Second Amendment. But when we no longer need people to keep muskets in their home, then the Second Amendment has no function. So my answer would be, yes, the Second Amendment is outdated in the sense that its function has become obsolete. And in my view, if the court had properly interpreted the Second Amendment, the court would have said that amendment was very important when the nation was new. It gave a qualified right to keep and bear arms, but it was for one purpose only, and that was the purpose of having militiamen who were able to fight to preserve the nation.
Finally, your late husband was a chef, I understand. I'm the chef in my house. I often have thought, and this came up in some of my readings about you, I've often thought that if anything happened to me, would my wife get the right kind of food, get someone to cook for her? Assure me that if the chef were to leave, someone would take care of my wife.
I nominate your 15-year-old daughter. I have a daughter who is now 58. But when she was about your daughter's age, she noticed a big difference between daddy's cooking and mommy's cooking. Up until then, I was the everyday cook. Marty cooked on weekends and whenever we had company. So my daughter, who genuinely loves good food, made Marty. She gave him sole command of the kitchen. And so for all the years I've lived in D.C., and now it's over 30, I have never cooked a meal. When Marty died, Jane took it upon herself to come every month, spend one day with me, spend the whole day cooking, fill my freezer, and so I continue to be very well fed.
You hear that, Zoe? Justice Ginsburg, thank you so much for a delightful afternoon.
Thank you very much.
You can hear part one of our interview with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and read the full transcript at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.